Welcome. It's 6 minutes past three. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show, and we've got a very special program today. As you know, when I get anti-Mormon callers, I usually give them very short shrift, because that's not what we do. But every so often, we'll give you an opportunity to take your best shot, and today is that day. The FAIR conference is underway in the Valley. That is the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. And I am going to have two guests today. The first in studio is Don Bradley. Don, welcome to K-Talk.
Thank you, Mills.
Appreciate your being here. Then we're going to be joined next hour with Dan Peterson, who is also speaking at the FAIR conference. Let's give the audience a little of your background so they'll understand maybe why you're involved in this very important enterprise. You were a member of the church, and you left it, correct?
Yes, for 5 years.
And now you're back.
Yes, as of 3 years ago.
And one of the things that the antis love to do is they say, well, we've got all these ex-Mormons, and they never get back into the church, and that's maybe not necessarily so.
Oh, it's not true at all. It's completely false. Not only have I come back, but I'm aware of several others who have as well, including one very prominent ex-Mormon, one of the so-called September Six, who were excommunicated in September of 1993, and that is my good friend Maxine Hanks, who was rebaptized last year. And Maxine will actually be at the FAIR conference with me. She'll be giving multiple presentations and will be part of a panel of people who have left the church and then returned.
I don't know if you want to be personal or not. That's entirely up to you. But can you describe for the audience what is it that usually separates most people from the church?
You know, there's really no one route out of the church. There are definitely different paths. If you look at the social science research, the main reason why people leave is actually they will tell the sociologists doing the study that it just kind of didn't fit with where they were in their lives, or, you know, the kinds of lives that they wanted to pursue, the friend groups that they had. But there's also a set of people who were very devout. And, you know, that first group of people, I think, are usually people for whom the Mormonism just didn't take. They maybe grew up in it, but as adolescents, it just didn't mean that much to them. They drifted off. The second group is people who were very devout, and they learned something about their faith, its history, maybe, that troubled them. And so they investigated it more, and they found more things that were troublesome to them. And there are a variety of issues like that, but a great many of them are church history issues, and then a few relate to Latter-day Saint scripture, like the Book of Mormon and the Book of Abraham.
Okay. I'm thinking of someone I know that was very devout and started talking with people who were antis, and they kept bringing up Joseph Smith's polygamy, mm-hmm. and this was deeply troubling to this person, and they too came back into full fellowship.
Really?
That's the kind of thing you're talking about.
Yes, yes. Yeah, issues surrounding Joseph Smith's polygamy, that is one of the common ones.
Okay. Why don't we tackle that just for fun?
Sure.
Because there are facts, and then there are lots and lots of fiction.
Yep.
Let's separate the two.
Okay. So first let me tell you kind of what my background is with respect to this topic. So I did my first church history research at the age of 17 at the LDS Church Archives. I was, not surprisingly, the only 17-year-old there. I started one of the early topics that I started looking into was Joseph Smith's polygamy. And then several years ago, I was hired by Brian C. Hales, who's an LDS anesthesiologist who was working on books on Joseph Smith's polygamy. And he hired me for 2 years as the primary researcher for him on this topic. And the goal of this research was for me to identify and get copies of every source that's ever been cited and anything that's ever been written on Joseph Smith's polygamy, and then to see what else could be found. And so I did that with Brian, and also found hundreds of new sources and went back to Yale and mined the D. Michael Quinn collection and other collections there, went back there twice to make sure we really covered our bases. So Brian's books are now out. They're titled Joseph Smith's Polygamy, and it's 3 volumes. They're huge. But they make use of every single source that's known. So that's my background on this topic.
So you're fairly conversant with this topic.
you could say that, yeah.
Yes.
And there are a lot of fictions or perhaps simply misinterpretations sometimes.
Some undocumented stories.
Yeah, well, sometimes people have the understanding that Joseph Smith's earliest plural marriage to Fanny Alger in the 1830s was not a marriage, that they believe that it was adultery. And they believe this because there are some early sources who believe that. There were people who didn't know what was going on with... If Joseph Smith's polygamy was secret, okay, and then people discover that he has a relationship with a young woman, they weren't automatically going to jump to the conclusion that it was a marriage. They were going to jump to the conclusion that it was an affair. And a few years ago, actually right as I was coming back to the... Starting before I came back, started to come back to the church, I tried to assess all the evidence on this case of Fanny Alger. So I looked at all the sources, looked at all the, and tried to weigh, you know, which evidence favors it being a marriage, which evidence favors it being adultery. And I was actually quite surprised at this point as a non-believer in Joseph Smith's prophetic mission. I was quite surprised at how decidedly the evidence weighed in favor of it being an early plural marriage rather than an affair. And I've written, I have a published piece on that that goes over all this. It's in a book called The Persistence of Polygamy, Volume 1, that the John Whitmer Historical Association has put out, and mine is the first chapter in that book.
And you came to this conclusion when you were out of the church?
Yes, yes. I had gone through a period while I was out of the church where, when I thought that it was just an affair, but then while I was still out of the church, I had weighed more of the evidence and come to the conclusion that it was, in fact, a plural marriage.
What percentage of the so-called marriage, plural marriage events in Joseph Smith's life were, I don't know how to say it, not necessarily platonic, but they were not consummated. They were...
Yeah, see, this is an open question. We know that Joseph Smith was sealed to quite a few women. He was sealed to over 30. And there's evidence of sexual relations in maybe about half of those cases. And in some cases, the evidence is quite strong, like we have a record from the woman herself, and in some cases it's more like a rumor, you know, second or third hand.
Hearsay.
Right, and so in those cases it's less definite. One of the big questions has to do with Joseph Smith's sealings to women who were actually legally married to other men. This is like one of the big cans of worms in Mormon history, and one of the issues that people often leave over. And it's Brian Hales in his books tries to lay out all the sources on that. and tries to really weigh all of the evidence, he concludes that Joseph did not practice what he calls sexual polyandry. So these other marriages were just eternity-only ceilings. They weren't relationships for this life. And I think that people who maybe have assumed that these marriages were, those ceilings were full marriages, you know, consummated marriages, will be quite surprised at the amount of evidence that he can bring for a differing conclusion.
Interesting. Well, I'm really appreciative of your being here. And I wanted to start with that topic because that's one of the hot buttons that most antis jump on.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
We'll get into many of the others as well. Before I launch into a discussion of what Farms is all about, let's... open the phone lines, 801-254-5855. Now, those of you who are decidedly anti-Mormon, this is one of your rare opportunities where I actually invite your call. We're not going to get into a shouting match or anything like that, but if you have a question that's rational and respectful, we'll have at it. I think that's only fair, particularly sure. Since the FAIR conference is underway. Now, I am producerless today. Liam told me last week that he was going to be gone for the balance of this week, so today and tomorrow I will be producerless. Be patient when you call in. Let the phone ring, and I will answer it as quickly as I can, and we will take your calls in the order in which they are received. The number, 801-254-5855. Tell us about FAIR and how it came to be, if you have that information.
I'm not very conversant with its history. It's been around for several years. As you said, it's the Foundation for Apologetics Information and Research. And so its reason for existence is to deal with criticisms and with troublesome issues that arise in Mormon history and about Mormon scripture and so on. And FAIR has on excuse me. There's a FAIR website, fairlds.org, and on this site they've got what they call the FAIR Wiki, and that it's like a little Wikipedia, and it has articles on various criticisms that are raised against Joseph Smith and against the church, where it tries to lay out the other side of the story. You know, the differing breadth of perspective, and that's quite good. And then every year in early August, they have this FAIR conference. It's usually been in Sandy. This year, it's in Provo at the Utah Valley Convention Center, and that's actually Thursday and Friday of next week, so August 1st and 2nd. And they have quite an assortment of speakers, and Dan Peterson, who's your next guest, is always a speaker there. Mark Wright, friend of mine, is going to be a speaker this year. Morris Thurston, who's quite a good legal historian, will be there. And Maxine Hanks, whom I mentioned earlier, who was one of the September 6 excommunicated almost 20 years ago and now returned to the church, is going to be speaking quite a bit also. So a really broad range of topics are covered, from things relating to the Book of Abraham, different aspects of the Book of Mormon, to Joseph Smith's polygamy has been a topic, women's issues, which Maxine will be helping to address, and it's quite well attended, and it's really fun.
One of the things you've done a lot of research on are the contents of the missing pages.
Right, the lost 116 pages.
And as a start to that, we need a break. We'll be right back. Okay. Back to the discussion we were having. My guest, by the way, is Don Bradley from FAIR. Don, how many different people have published what they say is the missing 116 pages?
There are not a lot of people who've published that. There are a few people who have published what they report are is the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon.
And they got those how?
Like angels or by revelation.
I see. Okay.
You know, so, yeah. And then there is one of those who also says that he translated, I believe it was that he retranslated the lost pages, and that's, you know, he's got a PDF of it online. Mark Hoffman, of course, very famously was working on his own.
And of course, that set was signed personally by Joseph Smith, I'm sure.
yeah. I actually have a copy of Mark Hoffman's notes that he supposedly took from the lost 116 pages. You know, this was one of the things that led to him actually killing people, is that he claimed to have found a couple very important collections, the McClellan Collection and the Lost Pages. And so he had notes from the Lost Pages that he was showing to potential buyers, and yet he found himself unable to really figure out how to forge these well enough, and so there was this lag of time that was growing, and he feared that people would start to realize that he didn't really have the goods, and that's when he began murdering. I've looked at Hoffman's notes, and just wondering, kind of, did he get very much right? Does what he put in these notes match some things that we know from other clues and sources about what was in the Lost Pages? And as far as I can see, he didn't get anything right.
Interesting. Well, what do you talk about the clues? How do you track down something that doesn't exist anymore?
Right. So first, biblical scholars do this sort of thing all the time. Biblical studies with the Hebrew Bible, you have the sources that they postulate behind the Pentateuch, the books of Moses, and none of those sources actually still exist in those original forms, but they believe that based on clues in the text, they can reconstruct what they were. New Testament scholars do this with the Q document or the Q source that is behind some of the material in Matthew and Luke. But for my project, broadly, there are two types of evidence. There's internal evidence in the Book of Mormon text that we still have. So there are places where, for instance, Mormon will do a sort of glance back to some earlier event. Like this happens in Mosiah 11, where he refers to this time when the children of Nephi had fled out of the land and taken refuge at a certain hill. But he refers to this as if we should know this story, but it's not in our Book of Mormon because it was in the Lost Pages. That's why he could assume we would have known it. But since we don't have those pages, you know, we don't know the whole story. But what he says there gives us a clue. And then there are other clues within the text also. So the small plates from 1 Nephi through the Words of Mormon sort of recaps the same history that was in the Lost Pages. So we have some of it there. The second type of evidence is external evidence. And here there are a few different kinds of evidence. The most obvious are direct statements. So there's one case in which Joseph Smith told people just a little bit about Ishmael that was given in the Lost Pages, but that's not in our current Book of Mormon. In another case, Emer Harris, Martin Harris's brother, gave a talk at a state conference where he told more about Mulek, the founder of the Mulekite people in the Book of Mormon. But what he was telling us is not in our current Book of Mormon, but he said it came from the Lost Pages. And I stumbled on that source, basically, at the church archives in meeting minutes. And then there's...
What kind of information comes out of that? That's fascinating.
It's not a whole lot, but it's something that's more than what we've gotten, something we can work with to try to figure out more. So basically what he says in that source is that when Nebuchadnezzar came and sacked Jerusalem and captured Zedekiah and put out his eyes and so on, Mulek and others hid. They fled, they hid, and that the group that fled that he was in, they were all members of the royal household, so apparently the extended family, you know, the descendants of David, and that there were four men and there were four women. And says just a touch more about them journeying to the new world, but there's a significance that I wouldn't have time to go into in what he describes about them all having been of the royal household, and this number of four males and four females there, those eight who had fled. And then there are other sources that are more extensive. So, for instance, there's an interview that a non-Mormon did with Joseph Smith Sr. very early, where Joseph Sr. told him the story of the Book of Mormon, the story of the Nephites, but with elements that are not in our Book of Mormon, but that would fit beautifully. For instance, the biggest, the most impressive one in his narrative is about how the Nephites found the Jaredite interpreters, the Urim and Thummim, that the brother of Jared receives on the mountain. And our current Book of Mormon text, you know, we see that King Mosiah II has the interpreters, but it never tells us how he got them. And, you know, his story comes right after where the Lost Pages ended. So that story was apparently in the Lost Pages, and we have part of that story through this interview. And then there are other types
and
of external.
What did he say about how they got them?
Well, he gives this fascinating narrative where someone is apparently they're Nephites here in the New World and they're journeying, and on their journey they're being led by the Liahona, this compass-like device that they have, and they have a tabernacle with them, like a portable temple, like the Israelites during their exodus. And so they're apparently on a kind of exodus between, where they're in between temples. And he says that having been led by the Liahona, this guy is led to this other device, and he doesn't know what it is or what he's supposed to do with it. And so he goes into the tabernacle, and as soon as he walks in, the voice of the Lord asks him, presumably from the other side of the veil within the tabernacle, "What is that in your hand?" And these are the words from the interview that he said, he answered that he did not know but had come to inquire. And then the Lord tells him to take this instrument and put it on his face and then cover his face over with animal skins. And when he does, he's able to see anything. You know, he becomes a seer.
Hmm.
And there's a lot more about that can be fleshed out from other clues, but that's what's in the Joseph Smith Sr. interview.
Well, you can begin to understand why I thought it would be exciting to have Don on the show, and why the FAIR conference itself is very significant. Because we're talking about some of the top researchers in the church who dig into ancient history and matters Mormonia,
yeah,
if that's a word. And this is your opportunity to ask any question at all. We can't promise to give you answers, but we'll do our very best. And the telephone number, again, is 801-254-5855. Again, 801-254-5855. What are some of the pet hobby horses that you hear over and over again? The challenges and the questions that people raise
from critics.
Yes.
You're saying. Yeah.
Well,
so
how about yourself?
You mean what were some of mine?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. The topic that I brought up earlier, the so-called polyandry, where Joseph Smith was sealed to women who were legally married to someone else, that was one of them. There were reading the Book of Mormon, for instance, the way that the King James Bible was used in the Book of Mormon, issues surrounding the Book of Abraham, where, it doesn't, the content of the Book of Abraham doesn't match the content of the papyrus that it's presumed to come from. The Kinderhook plates are a really common one, and actually one that I presented on previously at a fair conference. There are a number of them, and there are really a lot surrounding Joseph Smith's polygamy for sure. But those are some of the biggies.
And if any of you have questions regarding those issues, you don't have to be a member of the church. If you are an open critic of the church, I would be very disappointed if we don't get a call from Carl. Carl is one of our regular listeners who is a former member of the church and is decidedly anti. I believe it would be fair to say that he has come to the conclusion that God doesn't exist.
And that's where I was about 5 years ago. When I left the LDS Church, I did not believe in God at that time, which was, it was actually 8 years ago yesterday that I had left the church. It was on Pioneer Day that I had hand-delivered my letter to my bishop asking that my membership be removed. And I didn't believe in God, and I believe by that point I was an atheist and was for a few years. And that had to do partly with the problem of evil and suffering, like how could I explain the suffering of children and things like that. I was even, for a little while, not too long, but I was kind of in the new atheist camp, you know, like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris, who was my favorite of that bunch. And so I was very critical of religion and thought that basically we needed to scrap it.
I'm curious, what brought you back into the church?
So what brought me back was kind of the reverse of what had taken me out. I had gone out of the church because over a long period of time, I'd found a lot of things that clashed with how I had understood church history and thought that it should be. And I eventually, you know, I couldn't really explain things. Also, I started to pursue, as a historian, I had as my working model of Joseph Smith the opportunist. I thought he was in it for himself, for self-aggrandizement, and that, for instance, that's what polygamy was about. I pursued that perspective for years, and it was actually during that time that I was working for Brian Hales for 2 years on Joseph Smith's polygamy. So I had plenty of opportunity to develop the idea, you know, that Joseph Smith was this guy who was a fraud, who was after money, sex, and power. What ultimately happened is that this model just didn't work. I was trying to explain the man, I was trying to explain his life, and I couldn't. There were so many things about him that I couldn't explain, and I couldn't explain why the religion he created worked on this model that he was just this superficial charlatan. And so I started to find very good things in my research that were more affirming.
Well, that's no
fun. Faith. which was anything but what I expected, because I was pursuing this model of Joseph Smith as opportunist. And so I experienced this clash, this dissonance, and I started asking different questions instead of just asking.
We're gonna pause for a commercial break, and then I want to get back into this because I find this very fascinating. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on KTOC. We'll be right back.
Drive Time Live with Mills Crenshaw.
3:44 in the Mountain West. We have two callers on the line. Actually, we have three callers on the line now, and we'll go to them in turn. Carl will be up first, then Jan Lee, and then another caller that I will take right now. But finish the thought that you had before.
So I was saying that I started asking some different questions than the questions that had guided my earlier research. In my earlier research, my assumption had been that Joseph Smith was a fraud, that he was in it for himself. And when pursuing that made me hit a wall eventually in my research, then I took a different direction. So the question basically I'd been asking was, what's in it for him? You know, for everything that came out of his mouth, I was asking that question. And now I started asking questions also about how was he doing things to serve other people, what could have been his sincere religious motives, how was he trying to serve God. And I found that the questions that came out of my new perspective actually broadened my historical understanding greatly. And so that sort of began some spiritual changes in me, but the spiritual and the intellectual actually worked together. They worked in synergy in my life at this point, and that's when I was coming back to the church.
Very interesting. I appreciate your patience, Carl. Welcome. You're on K-Talk.
Yeah.
Hi, Carl.
Seemed like your organization, FAIR, that should stand for Fantastic Archaeology in Ruin. I'm thinking about the Book of Mormon and the scenario where it's allegedly taking place. Well, we have to look to Joseph Smith, what his opinions were. He said several times that the Book of Mormon scenario is in eastern part of the United States, around New York, Manchester. One time he was traveling with his wife Emma through Illinois, and he told his wife that this is Book of Mormon land right here around the Great Lakes. There's absolutely not a shred of archaeological evidence to support those claims. But certainly Joseph Smith, as he was writing up his fictional work, he was describing the area in which he lived, in which he traveled.
Carl, let's take one step at a time. You've made an allegation. That's fair. You're more than welcome to do that. Don, is there a shred of archaeological evidence?
So, Carl's talking particularly about a certain model of Book of Mormon geography that, as he's saying, that people ground in early Mormon statements, like things that Joseph Smith is reported to have said. And so, for instance, I gave a paper a few years ago in Independence, actually, on an incident that happened during the March of Zion's Camp, where some of the men dug in an Indian mound and they found a skeleton. And Joseph Smith said later that it was Zelph, who was a white Lamanite. So people, can point to that and say, well, there you go. That means that Book of Mormon geography, should have been in the, eastern or middle of North America. Mark Wright, actually, who's a good friend of mine, is presenting at the FAIR conference it's Thursday or Friday of next week, and he's addressing his topic is, what do we make of this North American Book of Mormon connection, since he and most other LDS scholars place the events of the Book of Mormon in Central America, where there certainly is evidence of a very advanced civilization.
What evidence is in Central America that Israelite civilization existed there? Can you give me some in terms of how people lived, the way they built their homes, the way they domesticated plants and animals? Can you prove any of that?
So I could point you to others whose area of specialty actually is archaeology, while mine is LDS church history. So I'm going to be more conversant in things like the Zelph incident itself. I don't know whether you've read John Sorensen.
Yeah, I've read his fiction.
How about Brant Gardner?
Never heard of him.
Well, he's one that you ought to be familiar with.
Okay, what's he say?
He's done a large multi-volume commentary on the Book of Mormon.
And where does he place the Book of Mormon?
He places it in Central America, and
okay.
He examines things in the Book of Mormon against the backdrop of the culture there. And
yeah.
I'm not conversant enough with his work that I would want to speak for him, so I'm not going to go on a tangent of Book of Mormon geography.
Well, I know who lived there.
Because it's not my area.
Yeah, I know who lived in Central America. It was the Mayas and the Olmecs and Mixtecs and various other American Indian tribes, mm-hmm. who have no relation whatsoever to Israelites. They had a different form of writing, totally unknown to anyone at the time it was discovered. I mean, it's unlike any writing, in the world. And that's why it took so long to decipher it. It's not like Israelite or Hebrew writing. It's not like Egyptian. It's nothing like the Middle East. It's nothing like European languages or Siberian writing or Chinese. It's a total class by itself. Has no relation to the Book of Mormon, which is nothing more than the imaginations of this scam artist called Joseph Smith.
That's First Carl.
Yeah. I used to believe this crap until about age 16, when I began to read about the migrations into the Americas from Siberia. And ever since then, yeah, I have not believed in the Book of Mormon other than that it's the imaginations of Joseph Smith. And he did it for nothing more than power, money, and sex.
And that was my working model for a few years or several years.
Okay.
Myself. So,
what convinced you that the Mormon Church was true when at one time you were convinced it was false?
So let me mention Mark Wright again a little bit more first, and then I'll go to that.
Okay.
Carl, you ask a question. Let him answer.
I want to know who this Wright is. Is he an archaeologist?
Yes, he's an archaeologist.
For whom?
Who specializes in Mesoamerica.
For whom? BYU.
He's at BYU.
Does he work for farms?
No.
Okay. Well, go ahead. You were saying.
Unless you have particular background in archaeology, I think neither of us is an expert on that. But there are people who are experts, like Mark, who very much see the Book of Mormon fitting into that setting. And like I said, he's going to be addressing some of that. And also the question of what about... I believe he will be arguing that there actually were Nephite or Lamanite peoples who spread outside of Central America and who maybe were in North America and places like that, which might explain what you were referring to earlier about these incidents where Joseph Smith talked about the ruins from Book of Mormon peoples.
Carl, let me make this suggestion. I'm going to have Professor Dan Peterson on.
Okay.
You're welcome to call back after he lays out his treatise, and we'll give you a chance to get more into this.
Okay, that's fine, yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate your call. We want to welcome now Dan Peterson, Professor Peterson. We welcome you to K-Talk, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Don.
It's a pleasure to have both of you, and I want the audience to know that they are welcome to call in, particularly if you are either non-Mormon or you consider yourself to be anti-Mormon. This is one of those rare occasions when we invite your calls, and we invite you to give it your best shot, because we've got a couple of these gentlemen who are going to be speaking at the FAIR conference. Professor, what are you going to be presenting?
Well, it's still a bit up in the air. Mine always is. But my title that I've chosen is Toward a More Effective Apologetics. And I'm going to be looking at suggestions I have for how we can be more effective, more efficient in defending the church against criticism and advocating the gospel. I think a lot of what we've been doing has been good, but some of it's been wasted effort or misdirected, and I'm going to be introducing a new vehicle that I think people might find useful for that, about which I really don't want to say more because I'm wanting to have a really big dramatic announcement on Friday.
Well, we'll look forward to that. I'm very interested. One thing I've wanted to ask you for some time, and a good friend of mine, Martin Tanner, suggested I ask you about this.
Yeah.
As I understand, there all of the Muslim world think that Gabriel was the one who talked to Muhammad.
Yeah.
And I have understood that there is at least a member of the BYU faculty that believes that that's not accurate, that Muhammad may have spoken directly with the Lord.
That may be me. I don't know that he did, but I noticed that at the very beginning, in the earliest accounts, Gabriel is not identified as the vehicle of revelation. It's the Spirit of the Lord, the Ruach al-Qudus, which means basically the Holy Spirit. But then some of the early accounts actually have Muhammad coming out of a cave where he's been meditating and seeing an enthroned being on the horizon who speaks to him. Now, later Muslims say, well, that's Gabriel, but in fact Gabriel's never associated with a throne, and the description seems to me to be more likely a view of God. Now, that seems to me the earliest account, because later Islam can't countenance the idea that God is in the form of a human being. But I think that's what Muhammad originally claimed. Now, of course, whether he actually saw that or not, I can't judge, but that, I think, was his earliest claim. And then, maybe even within his lifetime, but certainly within a century or so afterwards, Islam concludes that God can't be seen, so that can't have been God.
And so they tried to justify.
Yeah, and so Gabriel is identified as the vehicle of revelation, and that's what just about every Muslim in the world would believe today. But I think the earliest story may have been a different one, that it's Muhammad seeing an enthroned being, you know, a human anthropomorphic being seated upon a throne, and that's almost certainly God, not Gabriel.
Fascinating. I really appreciate that. I've wanted to ask that question for some time. Jenna Lee, welcome back.
Hi, thanks, Mills, for having me. And I'm glad to hear that you're going to be teaching about how to defend from the church, because it seems like I've had to do that my entire life, is defend my beliefs.
Yeah.
And so I am related to Joseph Smith through Silas Smith, the brother of Joseph Smith Sr. And the Jesse and Silas Smith raised my great-grandpa, Jesse N. Smith, because Silas died during the Missouri persecutions. And so he knew Joseph Smith up close and personal. And I am through Jeanette Johnson, his third wife. And he had 12 girls and one son. And the son is my grandfather. And so five wives and 44 kids. But I just wanted to say, if I could, since you guys are kind of historians, I mean, you are historians. Because my dad was a big reader of everything that of fair and of farms, and my great, this is something that was in Jesse and Smith's journal that people might have heard descriptions of Joseph Smith, but this account is so unusual that when I've told people about it, they love it. So if I could just read a couple of lines from it, is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. So Joseph Smith helped to raise my great grandpa, and he has this to say. I may say I was never so impressed by any person. I am unable to fully describe my sensations when in the presence of this wonderful man. I only know that I rejoiced being in his presence. No voice that I had ever heard seemed to me to be such a voice. I have never heard any human voice, not even my mother's, that was so attractive to me. Even his bitterest enemies, if they had the privilege of hearing him speak, became mollified and forgot their anger. Now I believe even his murderers at the last, if their passions could have been stilled, if their anger by which they were enraged and were no longer men, could have heard his voice, his impressive voice, and listened to his explanations, I do not believe they would have demanded his life. I will speak of the domestic life of the prophet. my mother being a widow, he noticed her children. She had two sons. He asked them to his house. He made them welcome. They were at liberty to remain in his household. His domestic animals loved him. He was very fond of horses. He had fine horses and one remarkable dog. They rejoiced when they saw Joseph Smith because he took care of them. He recognized them in their place as God's creatures. Anyway, he was especially neat in his appearance. He was unusually tidy. And it just says that he would have gladly given his life for Joseph Smith's life. He was that impressed with Joseph Smith. Mm-hmm. And so I'm happy to hear that people do religious studies, and I've been interested in it. I heard this, and I was really interested.
I appreciate you sharing that.
I wonder if that's available anywhere in print, or if you... Because if it isn't, I'd love to have a copy of it.
Really?
I don't believe that I've run across that before, but I know other people are more systematic at collecting things like that than I am, but if it hasn't appeared anywhere else, I would love to see it appear or be cited somewhere.
I'd be happy to send it to you. Okay.
Jenny, thank you. I appreciate that contribution. That's valuable.
Okay, thanks for letting me call in.
Bye-bye.
See you. Bye-bye.
Telephone number 801-254-5855. Zach, welcome.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good, thanks.
Great.
And we appreciate your calling from Layton.
Hey, thanks. I just wanted to bring up, I actually work with a guy who's extremely anti-Mormon. And the one thing that I bring up with him is if you don't agree with the Latter-day Saint people, you can at least agree with the way that they were unconstitutionally treated and how their actions and their existence, even just that, it begs and begs for the rights of the Constitution, and whether you agree with them theologically or not, it doesn't matter. And I think here in Utah, our responsibility after having all that persecution is to make sure that we don't legislate things and cause things that may cause, not to that extreme, but also, I think even just the smallest degree of evil, whether it's coercion or whatever it may be, we just need to be very careful. But also just horses and the basic stuff. How do we combat that? I kind of am all over the place. I'm sorry, but a lot of really good subject. I really like that.
How do we combat what?
How do we
claim that there were no horses here?
No horses and just theological things. And also how we can back that up with the Constitution and with other things that we already have in our arsenal.
I suppose I can respond to that a little bit on the horses issue. There's still some issues regarding the Book of Mormon to which we don't have definitive answers. I think the horse question is one of them. We have answers to a lot of others, and there are a lot of strong points to the Book of Mormon. There are a couple of lines of response that have been suggested on the horse issue. One is, and I know some critics ridicule it, but it's not as crazy as it may seem to them, or as they want it to seem. One is that the term horse is being used for something that we would not classify as a horse. You know, different languages and different cultures don't always classify things the same way we do. So a Nephite might have seen an animal that struck him as, you know, similar to a horse in some way, similar to the horses he knew, and called it a horse.
And there's plenty of precedent for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the most obvious one, I suppose, is the hippopotamus, which in Greek means a river horse.
Okay.
It's not a horse at all, but to the Greeks, it struck them as like a horse. Now, we think that's kind of funny, but that's how they did it. And
so with
and even
the translation
today,
from Reformed Egyptian, Joseph Smith even may not have, there may not have been a word that we could refer to except for like maybe horse, and even like the Olmecs could be the Jaredites, and there's just so many different things.
Yeah, we just don't know.
Possibility, yeah.
But I've actually had some guests on the show that are indicating they're finding more and more evidence all the time of modern horses that carbon date to the appropriate period.
Yeah,
and also,
the other way that I wanted to go, there is evidence. There have been horse bones found in the appropriate layers in archaeological digs in Central America, for example. And usually the horse bones have been disposed of because the archaeologists have said, look, that's got to be site contamination. This doesn't belong here. There were no horses. But they've nevertheless found them in the right layers, and some have been carbon-14 dated, and they've dated to Book of Mormon times back to the time of Christ. So the evidence for horses is slight, but it's not non-existent.
And I think also, I mean, you can't prove the Bible, you can't prove all these things, you walk by faith, and I just think that a lot of people just aren't willing to exercise that faith on the seat of the Book of Mormon. So, great show.
Thank you. Appreciate the call. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to Drive Time Live, the Mills Crenshaw Show on K-Talk. We asked the professor what his main topic was, but Don, I don't think we found out what you're going to be speaking about.
No, so I mentioned earlier the panel discussion that I'll be doing next week at FAIR on Friday, which is of people who have left the church and then returned, like I have. But I also will be delivering a paper of my own. And this paper is on the first vision and its original setting. So some folks like Grant Palmer and Dan Vogel, whom I frequently pick on but who's been a good sport about it, they've asserted that since we don't have documentation of the first vision until like 12 years later, that it didn't happen, that it's a claim that Joseph Smith made up in the 1830s in order to deal with issues that were arising in the 1830s, like trying to shore up his authority as prophet, for instance. And so in this paper, I'm assessing whether the details that Joseph Smith gives in his first vision narrative in the various accounts match the context of the early 1820s, a teenage boy growing up in the Joseph Smith Senior and Lucy Mack Smith home, and I won't say too much, but just as a preview, I see a fit that's like hand in glove. For instance, Joseph Smith in one account famously said that the vision occurred early in the spring. In another less known account, Joseph said that he told the reporter, said, "My father had a clearing, and he said I had struck my axe there when I'd finished work the day before." And he says that that's where he went the next day to pray. Well, when you look at early spring for farmers in upstate New York, it turns out that winter and early spring are a time for clearing land so that then you can plant later. And the planting season doesn't actually start until a little bit into the spring, a few weeks at least, when the ground, when the snow melts, everything starts to thaw, and then it starts to dry up a little. And so Joseph Smith's, you know, these are in two separate accounts, but they integrate really well. They match. And so if he's making up this story in the 1830s, he's doing it with this shocking verisimilitude where he's like thinking, you know, future historians are going to look at this story and they're going to assess whether it fits my childhood in the early 1820s. I better make it right. Of course, he's not going to be thinking that if he's making it up for 1830s concerns like they claim.
Fascinating stuff. Steve from Salt Lake, welcome.
Yes, some years ago I read a book by a professor at BYU named James Harris. The book was called Written by the Finger of God, where he went to the Fremont Indian, I guess, cave writings and glyphs and stuff that are in central and southern Utah, and seemed to draw a comparison between the language of the Fremont Indians and what he termed Proto-Canaanite, which is a language or similar characters could be found in some parts of the land surrounding Israel, and I'm hoping I'm doing a good synopsis there of the story, but I thought it was really compelling. So when I hear Carl say there's absolutely no evidence of the language matching, you know, there being like a transoceanic language connection there, I just wonder what you guys thought, first of all, of that book, and then if there's been a concerted effort that you guys have seen, you gentlemen, of the Smithsonian suppressing evidence that might lend credence to the Book of Mormon story.
You know, I'd be hesitant to talk about a conspiracy or anything like that. I don't think there's anything of that kind. But there has been a war in American anthropology between what are called the diffusionists, people who believe in transoceanic contacts between the Americas and the Old World, and people who reject that and insist that that the civilizations here grew up pretty much in hermetic isolation from anything else. And those are two broad ideological streams, and the relations between them sometimes get fairly tense. And when one faction is in power, it's usually the ones who believe in isolation. They don't look very kindly on proposals, papers, ideas from the other camp. So there's been a bunch. The Smithsonian has been pretty squarely in the camp of those who believe that the Americas were isolated. But there's a lot of evidence now, it seems to me, for transoceanic contacts. Just, you know, leaving the Book of Mormon aside, just all kinds of things, including botanical evidence and so on, of things that made it from the New World to the Old or from the Old World to the New, that don't seem to have, it doesn't seem that it was possible they came just by natural means. They had to be transported in pre-Columbian times. So, you know, naturally, obviously, I have a leaning toward the diffusionist camp because of my belief in the Book of Mormon, but it seems to me there are a lot of things that the other side can't explain. But it's not a conspiracy. It's really just a disagreement between two ideological trends in the field. But I think, you know, another place to look would be work done by a fellow by the name of Brian Stubbs, mm-hmm. who teaches and has written on Uto-Aztecan, early languages in the, broadly speaking, the Great Basin area. And he's found evidence of Hebrew influence in some of the vocabulary. It's really, really interesting, if true. And I know a couple of really fine linguists who've been impressed by that. I'm not in a position really to judge it, since I know nothing about Uto-Aztecan languages.
Specifically the James Harris idea, where he actually will take the characters that are found in central Utah and put them side by side by what he calls Proto-Canaanite, and they're almost identical in several instances. Do you guys have to ask other professors from BYU, and they kind of don't seem to...
I'm not really familiar. I've heard of the book, but I'm not familiar with it.
Really compelling. I just wondered if it had any support amongst the faculty at BYU, or...
I don't think it's gotten a really good hearing, even at BYU. And, you know, people at BYU are cautious, as well they should be, about, you know, going down the wrong road or making claims they can't justify. And they're a little leery sometimes of looking at things like that. But to me, that's where the really exciting stuff comes from. Even if 9 out of 10 radical proposals are wrong, if there's one that's right, that's going to make a big difference. So I remember the book. I haven't looked at it in a long time, but you've piqued my curiosity. I want to go back to it again and see what some of my friends have to say about it. I thought it was very interesting. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, because I frankly believe that ancient people got around a lot more than we used to believe that they did. And they show up in the oddest places, and they tend to carve their names as we used to before we got environmentally sensitive. They'd carve their names and other things on rocks, and so you'll find curious stuff. You know, Greek influences in Afghanistan, Chinese Buddhist missionaries at the court of the Ptolemies in Alexandria, Egypt. I mean, people get around more than we used to give them credit for.
I actually have a story about the Brian Stubbs work that you had mentioned.
Uh-huh.
I was familiar with his preliminary papers that he had put out, and I know he's still working on his big work. But when I was in my non-believing period, I was just sure that Stubbs's comparison of the Semitic and Uto-Aztecan language families had to just be this slipshod apologetic job, right? But I didn't know enough about linguistics, much less the languages, to know this for sure. So what I did is I went online thinking I had the perfect way to debunk this with real evidence. So I went to some discussion boards where you have discussion between academics in linguistics. And I found I had found a thread where one of these guys was criticizing sort of cult archaeology theories and the linguistic aspects of them, where they would compare different languages and do a really bad job of it. And so I was sure that if I let this guy look at what Stubbs had done, then he would come back and tell me, oh yeah, he's doing exactly what I was pointing out in these other cases. So I did that. I contacted the guy. I sent him links to Stubbs' work. He wrote me back and he said, this actually looks pretty good. It's definitely not making the errors that I was talking about. And he admitted that he wasn't enough of an expert in the specific languages to fully judge, but he said methodologically it looked sound. So that was quite a surprise to me. But because of that, I have, even when I didn't believe, I always regarded his work as real evidence for the occurrence of the Book of Mormon story.
Yeah.
Steve, good contribution.
Good,
thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Okay, Brian Stubbs is a good linguist, and the trouble is that there aren't very many people equipped to judge, because how many people are there out there who know Hebrew and Proto-Hebrew, really early Hebrew, and Uto-Aztecan languages
right.
from the New World? I mean, there just aren't many in a position to judge.
Right.
That's one of the fascinating things about truth. Eventually, it does out.
Yeah.
And when claims are made and you find supporting evidence, you have to work very hard at discounting these things, I think. One man's opinion. Telephone number 801-254-5855. Let's go. Adam, you are up next, and then Durrell. Adam, welcome.
Hi, Mills and Professor Peterson. Hey, I just have a quick question for Professor Peterson. I listened to a lecture that he gave about 5 years ago at BYU Education Week, and it dealt with the Book of Abraham. And Professor Peterson, you mentioned a couple of words that were in the Book of Abraham that Joseph Smith could not have possibly known about at his time, but then later, archaeological digs and whatnot, they excavated these very words and they substantiated the Book of Abraham. And I can't remember the words, but I know you probably do. And
well, I'm trying to remember what I might have said. One would probably be a place name in the Book of Abraham called Olishem.
That was one of them, yeah.
Yeah, in recent years, in the Ebla tablets that were found in Syria, there's a place that looks like it would be in about the right location for the Book of Abraham's Olishem, that goes under the name of Ulusum, which is, Semitic languages, the vowels can change, but it looks awfully similar with the LSM. It looks very similar to Olishem and Ulusum, and that struck me as a pretty good bullseye. I'm trying to think what else I might have talked about. I've looked, for example, at the name Kolob, the star named Kolob that occurs in the Book of Abraham, and I think it's interesting because, again, you look at the three root letters, the consonants of the name, K-L-B, and they come out to the word for dog, Kalb in Arabic, Kalb in Hebrew, and Sirius is known as the dog star, and no one really quite knows why. My speculation, I can't prove it, is that Sirius, I'm not saying that Sirius is Kolob, but that someone might have gotten it confused or thought it was. It's very significant in ancient Egypt, for example. The rising of Sirius marks an important change in the Nile flood season, and Sirius was venerated and worshipped in many quarters. But they might have thought that that it was the dog star because the word Kolob was so similar to their word dog. On the whole, I'm not thinking of what that other word might have been. I mean, I remember one anti-Mormon who criticized the crocodile who appears under the lion couch in facsimile number one of the Book of Abraham, where Joseph Smith identified that as the idolatrous god of Pharaoh, and he says, "Oh no, that's just the crocodile god of the Middle Kingdom." Well, but the crocodile god of the Middle Kingdom was the god of Pharaoh. And, I just think what are the odds that, some yokel farm boy looking at this alligator or crocodile would properly identify it as an Egyptian god directly linked with Pharaoh? There are a lot of things like that that strike me as interesting. In the criticisms of the Book of Abraham that we mostly hear, people want to look at how Joseph got the text from the papyri. And I say, well, that's an interesting question, but let's, in the meantime, look at the text itself, what we have, regardless of how he got it. And that text is really, really interesting. I may have mentioned that the term kokabim, which is used for stars, is in fact the word that's used it's used in Arabic rarely, but it's used in the context of stories about Abraham. It's not the common word for star, but it shows up. Kawakib or kokav, same word that you find in the Book of Abraham. Now, he would have learned that from Hebrew, from his Hebrew studies, potentially, but the fact that he used it in the story of Abraham fits really, really nicely, because that's where it fits in Arabic and Hebrew tradition as well.